I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting in the arena across from my good friend, Benjamin Alira Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today, we have a very special guest, very special for me. He's a very good friend of mine. I've known this guy ever since I started teaching college at the junior college level years and years ago, where he was a part-time instructor. Lee Herrick, the poet, whose new book, The Gardening Secrets of the Dead, has just been released.
And it's a wonderful book. And our poetic license this week is from our very own Daniel Chacon. What is it going to be about, Daniel?
It's a memory about a past relationship. So stick around.
You have several.
Oh, no, that is not true.
Daniel.
Yes.
We're just getting into the new year. Have you kept your New Year's resolution so far?
I certainly have. Every single one of them to the letter.
Did you make any?
No.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that's why it's so easy to keep. I don't like to make New Year's resolutions. I like to make morning resolutions. So when I wake up in the morning, I make my resolution for the day.
Yeah. Well, I have a New Year's resolution.
And what is that?
I'm going to kiss someone this year.
Oh.
Kissing someone at my age is a very serious business.
And is this like kissing like once a week, once a day, once the entire year, kiss and then leave?
Let's take it one step at a time. Let's take it one kiss at a time.
And so your New Year's resolution is to kiss someone.
And to finish two novels this year.
Wow. When Ben says he's going to finish two novels in a year, I believe him. You'll finish them and have publishers even before they're finished.
Some guys have all the luck.
Some guys got all the luck. Well, Ben, I don't think it's luck. I think it's your honesty, your compassion, and your dedication to the arts.
I appreciate that, Daniel.
My New Year's resolution, if there were a New Year's resolution, is to... I need to love you more. I don't think my love has been good enough.
I agree.
Okay, and I know you're going to love our guest, Lee Herrick, the same way I do. So join us, stick around, and we'll talk to Lee Herrick.
We'll be right back. Lee Herrick is the author of This Many Miles from Desire. His poems have appeared in many literary magazines and anthologies, including the Bloomsbury Review, Zizava, Highway 99, a literary journal through California's Great Central Valley, and One for the Money, The Sentence as Poetic Form, among others. Born in South Korea, he lives in Fresno, California, and teaches at Fresno City College and in the Low Residency MFA program at Sierra Nevada College. Lee, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on your new book, Gardening Secrets of the Dead. I don't know if people know this or not, but our very first show on Words on the Wire was with Juan Felipe Herrera. And you know who did Poetic License? Do you remember, Lee?
I do. That was fun.
Yeah, Lee did the Poetic License. He did our very first one, and it was about community, and it was awesome.
And I remember that, and it was awesome. And you have to do some more Poetic Licenses for us, Lee, by the way.
Yes, as many as you'd like. Ben and I end up doing them all.
Because if you don't promise to do one, this interview stops right now.
So, Lee, congratulations on this book. Tell us about Gardening Secrets of the Dead. Where did you get that title?
Well, thanks. I'm happy about it. And the title of the book is actually a title of one of the poems. I think it's the third or fourth poem in the book called Gardening Secrets of the Dead. And so, you know, that poem captures a lot of what I think the book is working with. So, yeah, you know, I struggled with the title for quite a while. The first book, This Many Miles from Desire, that title had come to me probably 3 years before the book was even published. The second one was quite a bit more of a struggle. In fact, I changed the title.
What did it used to be?
For a while, I was working with the title Bone Echo. It never felt quite right, and so I knew that before the book was published, the title might change. And so, you know, I was just looking over some of the poems, and that one felt right.
You know, that really makes a lot of sense that you would call it Gardening Secrets of the Dead. I'm looking at a particular line right now. It says, "A dead woman told me gardening simply is laughing and swimming a chorus of little brown miracles." It kind of, in a sense, echoes the recurring images and recurring themes of this book, which is about a woman who gave birth and a child who doesn't know where that woman is. Is she dead? Is she alive? Whatever happened to her? But there's a lot of stuff about being a Korean adoptee in this book, much, much more than I think This Many Miles from Desire.
Yeah, you know, This Many Miles from Desire was written over the span of about 10 years. And during that time, I'd only been back to Korea once. I should say, just for your listeners, if they're not familiar with my work or my life, I was born in Daejeon, South Korea, and adopted at 10 months to the United States. And so the second book, Gardening Secrets of the Dead, was written in about a four-year span from 2007 or so to 2011. And during that time, I went back to Seoul. I went back to Daejeon, the city where I was born, and was able to fill in a lot of the missing parts of my life, be those cultural or even with nature and family. A lot of the questions that are working through the book are sort of responses of sort of an increased certainty that I had or an increased sense of license having been back to the city where I was born. And things like that. So, yeah.
Do you feel like going back to the city where you were born, that it was some kind of return? And I ask that question because it seems that your life wasn't that reality. It was a different reality than what you were born. So if it's a return, what kind of return is it?
A lot of what we learn, I think, as writers is good advice, things like write what you know. And for many writers, that is a place and a time and a person, meaning birthplace, birth town, and birth date. And so, of course, having those three things in place doesn't guarantee any writer or any person any kind of certainty or ease. But for the adoptee, at least many Korean adoptees that I know, those three things are not only unknown, they are often shifting. So in other words, I technically don't know the day I was born, and I haven't yet met any of my birth family. And I grew up most of my life believing I was born in Seoul, the capital city of South Korea. In fact, my first book, the bio, says I was born in Seoul. But in 2008, when I returned, I found out that I was, in fact, born in Daejeon. And so I think, at least for me, the poem or the art is a way to sort of navigate that middle ground. It's almost like a border or an anti-border where the language and the suppositions, culturally, geographically, chronologically, have to sort of be grappled with in the poem. But to answer it specifically, if I understood your question right, returning to Daejeon was for lack of a better term, it was an incredible experience. I felt something very strange come over me when I got off the express train in Daejeon. It was sort of hard to explain.
One of the things that really fascinates me about books of poems, ever since Ben and I have been doing this show, I read more books of poems in a week than I read anything else. And one of the things that interests me is when the poet has come to recognize that they have a book. And what is that recognition? Is it the amount of pages? Is it recurring images? Is it themes? When did you know that you had a book?
I think the first book, it was more just a number of pages, you know. I felt like
which often happens, I think, with first books. You just arrive at a number of pages and go, I think I can put a book together.
It was more that way with my first book. This one felt a little bit more deliberate in what I was trying to do thematically. And so I knew I was getting close when I had a certain number of pages, but there was a last poem or two that I wrote that I thought tied the collection together well, specifically the poem in the book called The Heart, which gave the book a sense of finality for me.
And so why isn't it the last poem then?
It's a really good question. I decided to put The Heart as the second to the last poem because the last poem that ends the book right after The Heart is called Freedom. And those two poems are, of course, part of the last section of the book. And that section of the book is really a series of poems that I was writing sort of during and after a difficult period of my life in 2008 in a personal way. A difficult marriage ended, and so I was writing a lot about the heart and perseverance and faith and things like that. So I knew The Heart needed to go towards the end, but Freedom opens up the book in a more general way to close it out, I felt. Freedom, not just about the heart or in a personal context, but just in a liberating way that might apply to anybody in any number of circumstances that they're going through. There's a line in Freedom that says, we have the open architecture for such capacity. And I think that I was trying to speak to a larger audience beyond just the personal or the relationship.
We're talking to Lee Herrick, whose new book just came out, his second book of poems, Gardening Secrets of the Dead. Lee, when you put this book together, did you print all the poems out and put them on the floor and decide where they're going to go, what order they're going to go in?
You know, I know I printed them all out, and I don't know if I was on the floor or on the kitchen table, but I did spread them out and look at them in that way.
That's got to be one of the most satisfying things for a poet when they know they have reached enough pages to print them all out, put them on the table or the floor, and decide the order of things.
It's a great thing. And, at least for me also, I'd say that you know you're getting close, but you're certainly not done, right?
Yeah. But that's when you start writing poems to make the book, to make it a book instead of just a collection of poems. So it'll have the kind of narrative arc that we want to give it.
Definitely. Definitely. And if nothing else, the laying out of the poems allows you to see those gaps that Ben might be speaking of there.
And you know what? Because I'm also a novelist, the novelist, when you finish a book, it doesn't have that kind of physical, visceral joy to it. Because you can't, the pages are they're numbered.
You can't
spread it all out. You can't, the decisions are already made, and you just print it out. And so, it's not fun that way. In the way that you have fun with poems, because that's also fun.
By the way, I have to mention, excellent job, Lisa. Lisa Lee, your partner, did with this cover. She designed it. It is so beautiful. I love how the robe of this young woman on the page with this really beautiful robe, technicolor robe, and as it streams down to the bottom of the page, faces emerge, children emerge, these people emerge. It's really beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you.
And can I ask you about something on the image that's really arresting? That the young woman is so feminine and fragile, and yet the hands are so masculine and large.
Mm. Yeah, the cover artist is a woman originally from the Cambridge, Boston area. She's a Korean adoptee, incidentally. But her name is Ju Young Choi, and she is an incredible artist. And so her cover is the one you're speaking of. And Lisa, my fiance, did a great job designing the book. The face of the woman on the cover, to me, is very Korean. This Korean concept of Han, or sort of a cultural sort of malaise or sadness, to put it one way. You know, Korea, of course, is a country affected by war, and that war, quote, sort of ended, although it's still technically going on, in 1953. And so there's a lot of weight, I think, in the woman's face. And yeah, her hands are heavy. I think her hands are darker.
Yes.
Yeah, it just felt like the perfect cover. I feel very lucky that she let me use it.
You grew up in Modesto, California, and where I used to live and I used to teach. In fact, Lee and I knew each other at the college I first taught at. We were both teaching there. But you grew up in Modesto, which is very middle American in a sense, very middle class, and it's quite white, frankly. Some of the neighborhoods there, I remember living there for a while and feeling very alienated at times as a Chicano. I remember being followed to my class. I was a professor, being followed to my class by security because I parked in faculty parking. I mean, it's really kind of a, you know, it's an interesting community. Very, very conservative. Very, very conservative.
Yeah.
At what point did you know that you needed to find out who you were?
Well, before I lived in Modesto, I lived in Danville. I was adopted, and then I sort of landed in the United States in October of 1971. And for about 8 years, I lived in Danville in the East Bay. And then my family moved to Modesto, which, as you say, is fairly white. It's now a city of about 200,000 people. And by car, it's only about an hour and 15 minutes from San Francisco. But in other ways, it's much further from San Francisco. You know, in the 70s, I was the sort of stereotypical situation where I was the only Asian kid at the school and things like that. So being an adoptee in a white family with whom I'm very close and love dearly, but nonetheless, they were Caucasian and I'm Korean. And so growing up, I had a fairly comfortable childhood, but the first time, if I remember your question right, the first time I started to think I needed to really be a little bit more aware of race dynamics or things like that, I think I was about 18. I was walking, no, maybe I was about 20 years old, and I was back visiting my parents, and I looked on the hallway wall, and they had gotten this photograph developed. It was a formal family picture. And, you know, this was way before cell phones with cameras and everything. And it was the first formal family portrait that I'd ever seen. We'd had a lot of other pictures taken, but they were all candid or, you know, out camping or doing whatever. But we'd never been in a studio with nice sweaters on. And I looked at this photograph. I was about 20. And it was one of the most striking memories I have of really, really looking different than them. I mean, of course, I knew I looked different than them growing up my whole life. But I remember that instance. It sort of jumped out at me. And that probably just coincided with the time of being in college and reading some good books. And that was a big, big turning point for me. That time, about 2021, I began to learn a lot. I began to travel a lot more, feel a lot more comfortable around Asian Americans and Korean Americans, which might sound strange, but as somebody who never did grow up around that, the food, the culture, the people, I almost had to relearn it as a 20-year-old. And so now I'm very comfortable around those things or in those countries. But that was a defining moment for me, and I think it was very liberating as a very young writer, realizing that those things were for me, that culture was for me, that there were problems with racism in the United States, and I could start to make sense of how they'd affected me.
You know, just as I suspected, and as is very evident in your work, your development as a poet, as an artist, coincides with your consciousness of who you are politically and socially and culturally.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
And Lee, to end today our interview, I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk. It's been wonderful to have you on the show. We always have a segment where we have the poem of the week. And when we have a poet, we have them read a poem. Usually we ask them to select a poem, but I've selected one that I'd like you to read for us today.
Okay.
Could you read Circle?
I'd be happy to. Circle, can I just say a word about the poem?
Yes, absolutely.
It's for Jennifer and Sun Young Shin. Sun Young Shin, as I think some of your listeners might know, is the great poet from Minneapolis. Her second book just came out with Coffee House. It's called Rough and Savage. And she's a spectacular poet, and she happens to be a Korean adoptee who I met when my book came out, the first book. It was the same year her book came out, 2007. And the other person to whom the poem is dedicated is Jennifer Kwon Dobbs, who also is a Korean adoptee. Her first book came out in 2007, the first year mine came out. So I went through a long period of writing where I thought I was the only one. And when our books came out, we were among the first Korean adoptees to have a book of poems published. It's been a wonderful, wonderful experience getting to know them and being inspired by them and so on. So the poem is sort of for them. It's called Circle. Once I thought I had memory, browned dry leaves in a pile, Korean, full of smoke, autobiography as division, north of the Han River, south of it, the 63 building, a gold rocket, all the red neon crucifixes lit under Seoul's hopeful twilight, the Imjing River's heavy bloat, the guard posts with handprints of former soldiers, like my translator who helped me try to find my birth mother. You write about paper and savagery, all the dying and flowers to the left, all the dying and flowers to the right, all the children eating popsicles to the left, all the children eating popsicles to the right. Your shattering elegance, you graceful astronomy, you turn into doves, you sword of fire through the snow, we will remember it all.
The lovely poem.
Thank you.
Thank you for being our guest on today's show, Words on a Wire.
For a poetic license today, I am going to read a memory. It's a true experience, I guess, as true as the past may be, because the past is memory, and memory is like a dream, and you sometimes connect the dots that may not have been there to begin with, but it's more or less true. The language is true, at least. The memory is true. Upside down broom. A witch told me at a party what I could do when I wanted people to leave my house. Take a broom and put it upside down, she said. Believe me, they'll leave. She was 22 and I was 26. I don't know if she was really a witch or just wanted to be, but she called herself one. On our first date, she told me how to get rid of curses and spells, something about placing a candle in a black bowl, how to bless my pen before I write a poem, how to make a circle with rocks, and what to put in the middle of it. She told me what I should say should I ever look into a black mirror. When she pulled out the Ouija board, I asked it would I get lucky that night. She smiled and said, "We already know the answer to that one. Ask something harder." I remember the phrase us boys used to throw around in junior high, it's colder than a witch's teat. And as we cuddled under the covers, I saw how foolish it was to talk that way. She was warm and soft, and I loved it when we spooned and I rubbed my nose on her neck. Maybe everything I had assumed about witches was wrong. I came to love her, I think. At least when I wasn't with her, I thought about her all the time. Her cold gray eyes, her way of handing me back the pack of cigarettes we shared when we got drunk together. But she was a witch. Or wanted to be, and I was an evangelical conservative Christian. I had been saved at 23 and had been going to church ever since. At first, I was on fire for the Lord and went every Sunday and Wednesday evenings, too. I was active in church events, picnics, evangelical prayer meetings, get-out-the-vote drives. At 26, when I met her, I was in a backsliding phase. I partied and played around, and I only went to services about once a month, but I still believe. I still took as truth what the church taught us, how you couldn't be saved without reciting the sinner's prayer, how God's chosen people could speak in tongues and heal the sick, give eyesight to the blind. I believed that even Catholics weren't saved, that it was a sin to pray to the Virgin Mary. And although it caused arguments with my Catholic family, I let them know that they were being deceived by the Pope, the Vatican, Satan's headquarters on earth. Please, get on your knees, I would plead, and pray with me, pray with me. Allow Jesus in your heart. There is hope. Most of all, I believed that witches went to hell. No exceptions. Some said that to practice witchcraft was blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, a sin that could never be forgiven. But I couldn't help but see her whenever I could. I slept over at her apartment, where she lived with two other roommates whom I hardly ever saw. We were in love, I think. I liked the way she curled into me like a missing piece, how her neck smelled of sandalwood. I liked to trace the pentagram tattoo she had on her pelvis with my middle finger and the scar above her hip bone from when she was a girl and her brother took a knife. One day, overcome with guilt and believing she was too good for hell, believing that it could work out between us, hoping that she might convert to what I then thought was the true religion, I invited her to the People's Church, a Walmart-sized conservative congregation. It pissed her off. You better not be one of those Christians, she said. What do you mean by those Christians? Evangelicals, she said. Hypocrites. I laughed as if the idea were crazy, like I had been joking the entire time. The next time I came over to her place, she was cold and sarcastic, saying, "Thanks for letting me know you'd be coming over," as she walked into her bedroom. I followed her in, and I saw it. An upside-down broom stood in the corner by her bed. "What do you want to do tonight?" I asked, standing by her door. As she strummed her guitar, sitting on her bed, she shrugged her shoulders.
Thank you, Daniel. That was really, really interesting. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, well, thank you, Ben.
We'll be right back. This is Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And I'm Daniel Chacon.
And we'd like to thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And we'd like to thank Lee Herrick for sharing his words with us and his beautiful poetry. And don't forget The Gardening Secrets of the Dead, available now.
At your local independent bookstore.
Or wherever good books are sold.
Next week we have with us Melinda Palacio.
And she'll be talking about her new collection of poems, House Fire is a Story Waiting.
And even though I really love poets, we better start getting some fiction writers in here.
Oh, yeah? Well, I'm a fiction writer. You're a fiction writer. I think we're represented. No, you're right. Fiction writers, we will get you on the show, we promise.
Thank you for listening.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubberneck giraffe, you look into my past. Well, maybe just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude seems to get to me. I'm up on a tight wire, flanked by life and the funeral pyre.